This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Ruslan, today we have the returns of, he's a filmmaker, he's a writer, he's an actor, he is Naar Murad.
Hi, hi everyone. Hi,
hello. And she, after a long absence, she's a theatre producer, a theatre director, a theatre actor, and a writer. She is Jo Cook with us.
Hello.
Hi, we are all in our various MCO locations on Zoom.
All wearing pajamas.
Yes, and all with our cats as well. And so our three topics this week is, topic number one is generational change. Topic number two is, well, maybe the 80s weren't that great after all. And topic number three is, this is the fun one, death. So,
ooh. Lovely.
Stick around for the comedy, folks.
Always look on the bright side of.
That's right. And so, with topic number one, generational change, there are three things that I've watched in the past that I think about and scare me to death. One is, there was this interview done back in 1964, I think, with Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones, and all the kind of establishment notable men of England in that time, in 1964. There was the Archbishop of Canterbury, there was Sir Bufton Tufton, there was some Greek, some fellow who spoke ancient Greek as a first language. I mean, they were all like really learned people. And everyone was being shocked by this new thing called the Rolling Stones and Beatlemania. So Mick Jagger turns up in his helicopter, very rock and roll, and then they proceed to explain to Mick Jagger the Rolling Stones. And they're all saying, you know, of course, this was a Dionysian experience for these girls. They're screaming. It's an ancient pagan rite. And Mick Jagger's just looking at them like, you know, who are these idiots? And after a while, he just casually says, well, the thing is that in England, he says, it's screaming girls. But when we play over on the continent, it's boys who smash the place up. And they didn't really hadn't really factored that in, because there are different cultural responses. But anyway, the thing is, now he is Sir Mick Jagger. He is the establishment, and all those fellas and the things that they really believed in are kind of gone. I mean, like, actually, no one goes to the Church of England anymore. The biggest act of worship religion in England is Islam. And another thing I saw was a documentary called Town Bloody Hall from the 1970s, when there was a discussion about feminism, and it had Norman Mailer, famous misogynist and author, and against him was Germaine Greer, who was a young Australian feminist, and she was so smart. I'd never seen or heard of her before when I watched it in the 80s. She was like so smart. She was my introduction to feminism, and she was incredibly glamorous and wiped the floor with this misogynist.
Dinosaur.
Now, Germaine Greer, who has been a standard bearer for feminism, has been cancelled because she has spoken repeatedly about how transgender women, in her opinion, are not biological women. And so she's gone too far. And the last one I want to mention is, there was the three of us know this movie very well, The Life of Brian by Monty Python, came out, there was another discussion, again with like the Archbishop of Canterbury and Sir Bufton Tufton, and with John Cleese, who is of the Monty Python crew, and they were saying, why are you making this movie? It's so disrespectful of Christianity that has given us the Renaissance and all these kinds of things. And he was saying, no, I'm not talking about Christianity per se, but organized religion. And so the three of us, and just about anybody involved in comedy, has grown up with Monty Python and can quote anything by Monty Python. But now, actually, John Cleese has, when he does make utterances, he does say things which are kind of like, a bit kind of, really? He sort of says things about immigrants and stuff that's a bit sort of, what?
So he's become a grumpy old man.
He's become a grumpy old man. Yeah. And so I'm worrying, personally, because now I am becoming of the age of all the grumpy old men who are involved in these things that I've told you about. And a younger generation is coming up who would perceive myself as being a grumpy old man when I was always thinking, hey, I'm on the cutting edge of the revolution, people. But, you know, so yeah, generational change. What do you think? Are you concerned yourselves?
So, old lion, new lion, partly story, right? I mean, change is going to come, as they say. But do you see this as being a problem, Cam?
No, this is the way it's always been.
Yeah.
And I'd never really noticed it because I was never really felt myself to be on either side of that generation thing. Mm-hmm. I wasn't saying, old people, get out of the way. And I wasn't saying, hey, I'm one of the old people. Don't hit me. But now it's just really dawned on me, and I see so many things that we think are cultural, political landmarks are actually all about generational change. When I talked about the Rolling Stones, I mean, that was the baby boomers coming of age. That was the first time you had so many young people, and they were just bursting into this collective scream in the direction of the Rolling Stones.
Maybe these things become very apparent at different times. So maybe like in the 60s, it was a revolutionary time. Mm. And so of course, you would be batting against an older generation who you felt had ruined things, right? You're not going to be listening to them. You don't want to. I think maybe the same thing is happening now, whether the pandemic has created this or just, the inequality has become so apparent in the last few years with the Black Lives Matter movement or the Occupy movement, that people are saying, well, this late stage capitalist system has messed up our lives and we need change.
But Cam, have you changed? Do you feel that, I mean, we're talking about John Cleese. It sounds as though he no longer quite believes in some of the liberal values that he held. But have you changed? Do you feel as though something that was very much part of you, you don't quite believe in anymore? Or do you find that whatever you believe in is no longer valid?
No, I think that I still very much hold true to my liberal values as much as I ever did, I think. I don't see any question there. I think I don't necessarily have the energy that back in the old days, one of the commodities that I would have had is energy. And the need to go out there and be involved on that level. Now the commodity that I have, I think, would be a thing called experience. and so I just wonder if that commodity has value. Sorry, Naam Murad is being invaded by his cat.
I understand the whole energy analogy thing. Been wanting to say that for years. I think, Cam, also like a lot of the change now is not like the Rolling Stones. It's not like a BLM. Definitely a lot of the movement is just people going out there and demanding change. There's a lot of energy to it. There's a lot of actual doing of something. But I think what some of the problem for the older generation is like there's a lot of argument over nomenclature. There's over small interpretations of what you feel about this and that. You would say something suddenly becomes cancelable. You know what I mean? There's a lot of stuff which is totally valid. But there's also things which you almost feel as though, well, you know, that's a very, very small argument. Let's not get deeper into it now because it's not as important as XYZ. I'm not going to give any kind of examples, but you guys know what I mean. And I'm sure your listeners know what I mean too.
What about you, Joe? Are you...
I think that it's interesting what you say about energy, right? So energy in youth translates later to less energy in middle age because you have experience. So you know when not to get overexcited, you know when not to have a quarrel, you know how to pick your battles. I mean, you know, how to lose the battle to win the war, for example. And I think, yes, at the moment, all these skirmishes happening about really tiny things. I mean, not to say language is not important, but I feel sometimes the incessant need to correct everybody's language and the incessant need to virtue signal, as the expression is, means that sometimes people are getting in their own way, getting in the way of actual change.
They're getting in the way of allies, people who could be your allies, and you are quibbling about certain things.
Yeah.
And the end goal is being ignored. Yeah. Or at least being shunted aside.
And I think you can do that when you have a lot of energy, you see. When you get to be our age, we're like, oh God, it's too tiring. It's too tiresome as well.
My point is, being on the internet is not using your energy, really. It's just sitting somewhere, munching on. I do it too. And then you just take pot shots safely. Mm-hmm. And you're not really engaging.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, and when Kemp talks about energy, I mean, we didn't sit at home and send emails to people in Kuala Selangor about the Sungai Selangor thing. We went there and we talked to them.
Right.
We could have been beaten up by thugs for all you know, but I'm not saying that, wow, yeah, so terror we actually went. But you know what I mean? There's that difference there. Mm. There's a kind of ease to the internet that allows you to just take pot shots.
Yeah. I think we've signaled our revolutionary credentials enough now. And so, young people, you know?
And three grumpy old people.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're in the trenches, man.
Okay. And speaking of the trenches, topic number two, the 1980s. The 1980s. Not as good as you thought they were.
Well, okay. Well, it all has to do with the RMO, MCO, CMO, whatever you want to call it. I've been reconnecting with everything, just reading and listening to music and stuff like that. And I found that a lot of the 80s stuff, which I really love, it's not, I hate it now, but I just want to ask you guys what it is, what it could be. Right? For example, Frank Herbert's Dune, which I love, which is an incredible piece of world building. It talks about its time. And it's amazing that it was written in 1965, when Vietnam hadn't even started, and you see so much of Vietnam and Afghanistan and the whole oil issue in the Middle East and everything, it just remains relevant, but it can be so tedious. Frank Herbert he delights in having his characters have these 12-page-long conversations where they are picking every word that the other person is saying apart, and that it's fascinating, but it's also so long and so boring. It's like there's one scene where one character is dying, and in that character's death, that character realizes something about the ecology of the planet. And that could have been done today by you know, even with myself, thinking as a storyteller who's been telling stories for 30, 40 years, I would have encapsulated it in 2 pages. The thing is like 14 pages long. And he goes on and on and on. And I'm wondering, why do I not have that patience when I really loved it? And music, for example, like Roxy music, right? In the 80s, it was like, oh my God, Brian Ferry has the best voice. And now I'm listening to it again. I'm like, no, actually, he has pitchy problems, dog.
Well, it just so happened that when you told me about the Dune thing, I just watched a movie from the 1980s that I hadn't seen since the 1980s. And I had such fond memories of this film. I thought it was a great film.
I don't even remember it.
Oh, well, you know, I'm not saying it's one of the best of all time, but it was just a really fun film. And I watched it again recently, Midnight Run it was called. And it was like, this is so boring. This is so slow. Get on with it.
Yeah, is it because back then we were younger, so we had this kind of focus. When you had something that was considered great, something that everybody was saying was fantastic, that your generation was putting up on a pedestal, or something like Dune, where generations before had been putting up on a pedestal, that you had a certain kind of focus. You were determined to love it no matter what, whatever was thrown in, right? And now maybe the problem is the opposite of focus. I don't know. Now we're just a bit more impatient, or perhaps things are like, for example, Shakespeare. When you're in your teens, in your 20s, you're like, you hold on to every single thing. And what does it mean? It's amazing. You know, even if you don't understand it or you don't quite get it, you still try. And now it's like, you know, I read Shakespeare and I'm like, oh, enough with all these like metaphors about the human condition. Where are the dirty jokes? You know, it's like less patient. So, what do you guys think it is? Is it?
I don't know, Joe. Are you?
Well, maybe for me, it is being slightly older than gentlemen. A couple of years ago, I started watching things from the 70s, you know, which I didn't really like back then in the 70s.
Television or movies?
Movies. And then I was like, wow, movies from the 70s are really cool.
Really good.
Really good. And they had a kind of cool to them, you know. I remember like watching the new version of the Thomas Crown Affair. I thought it was just awful. I just really hated it. So I went back and I watched the old Thomas Crown Affair. And it's just so good. It's just excellent.
Well, it's got Burt Bacharach music. I mean, that's like cool. Or it's
got Stephen McQueen. Stephen
cool, you know, in Faye Dunaway.
Yes.
So, and it was effortlessly cool. Whereas the newish one, people trying too hard.
Yeah. I mean, I always felt about the stuff in the 80s, TV and movies in the 80s, and it all just felt a bit kitsch. When I think of the 80s, I kind of think big shoulder pads and slight overacting from everybody. That's kind of my feeling of 80s and a lot of things which were coming of age stories, which didn't really speak to me that much. I know people love things like The Breakfast Club and all that, but didn't really do it for me as much, really. And I think the 80s were not a big time for me for watching films apart from like Star Wars, those franchises, which was, I think, probably the biggest deal.
Well, if I treat the topic as less the 80s per se, but more to do with the things which were in my formative years, I think that in my formative years, when I was, I don't know, 18, 19, it was so easy to have my mind blown. Anybody could say anything and I'd be like, oh, that is just mind-blowing.
Everything is new, isn't it? Everything is a new concept.
Yeah.
I still remember in my late teens, I just finished my O-levels and I was visiting my brother in Australia and he invited me along to a lecture at his university. And, you know, for him it was an ordinary lecture and the topic was power. And I remember that very distinctly as being that moment when my mind was blown once and for all, because that made me interested in politics, maybe interested in philosophy, maybe interested in the idea of thinking, just going to this one lecture. So I think I was in a kind of strange situation growing up where I didn't get to watch many movies. I mean, being in a kind of school in the middle of nowhere in India, so movie watching was not regular. we got to watch one movie a term on an old, you know, reel. And we got to go to the cinema called Lushington Talkies.
And it was uphill both ways, right, to get there. And wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
So you people there were like, oh, is that the new Charles Dickens book?
It would be, actually. You know, I remember when they had...
What, he's dead?
When they had that film, Witness for the Prosecution, in my school, in our village. And they had the original poster with the sign across it saying, don't tell anybody the ending.
Yeah. Because by the time you watched it, Charles Laughton, who was in that movie, was dead.
Yes. Yeah.
But Joe, one question, Joe. We both love the Once and Future Kick.
I was just about to say that.
Has that changed for you? Because it hasn't changed for me. Some things just won't change.
No, I think if things are classics, and maybe that when you discover when something is not a classic as you think it is, you may love something when you're young, and then later you revisit it, and it doesn't hold up. It doesn't stand the test of time. I think Dune may not stand the test of time, whereas I think the Once and Future King is forever.
Yeah, Once and Future King, and for music, it's the B-52s. Yeah, they're actually better now for me.
Right.
Well, you guys are like, what? But yeah.
Well, you know, well, we got to wrap this one up. But I would just say two things. Now, one is really, I'd say the Roxy music is 1970s, and they're just as good as they ever were. And the other is, I want to ask a quick question. But Tolkien, you read Tolkien back at that time. Tolkien,
right?
No, I mean, is it? So are you scared to go back to it and discover actually it's a bit boring?
I have rediscovered. I mean, I've gone back to it a couple of times. I think I'm more patient with Tolkien because I really like the film, and I thought the film distilled what was powerful about Tolkien cinematically. And Tolkien wasn't really good at characters. I mean, he was good with his hobbits, because his hobbits were the closest to him. They were Englishmen. They were, you know, they were representation of his innocence before he went off to war. So the Hobbits were wonderful to read, but his other characters weren't so great. They were very fairy tale characters, and the film expanded that. So I don't know why that has allowed me to actually read Tolkien with a kind of forgiving nature about some of the more trite stuff, but it's still beautifully written. And in fact, even Dune, the strange thing is, even though I find things tedious, I now understand what he's trying to say in his tedium, in that long-winded way, what he's trying to do. I understand it more. It's just that I just find it a little bit boring. Maybe it's because as a storyteller myself, I know all the tricks now. It's been so many years. I've read so many things. I've even written things and you know, directed things and stuff like that. So you know all the tricks. You know all the storytelling tricks. And maybe that's why, at least for books and movies, some of the stuff from the old days has not held up. Music is a completely different thing. It's completely visceral.
No. Okay, we're going to move on. And in a moment, though, we're going to come to, well, the thing we've all been looking forward to and that we're all looking forward to in general, death on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Na'am Murad, and Joe Kukatas. And now, Joe, death.
Well, not just death. I've been thinking, of course, we've all probably been thinking a lot about death in the last few months. Because of COVID-19, people cannot have the same ritual that they have been used to when their loved one passed away. And it's been a painful experience for many people having to deal with death and not being able to see the person that they love, not being able to attend a funeral, not being able to see them before they pass away. And suddenly we're kind of reminded of how important that is, things that we take for granted. And so I've been doing a lot of reading about death. I was rereading some books that I read many years ago. One of them is a book by Julian Barnes called Nothing to be Frightened Of. And you know, he talks about the times in the past when people have met, like there's a famous group in Helsinki who used to meet every week, and they forced themselves to talk about death of Sibelius and all his counterparts. And in Paris in the 1920s, also groups of kind of intellectuals met, and death was the only topic on the table. And they used the time to talk about it, to confront it, because they felt that their society had moved away from being able to deal with it, because death was becoming less present. Right, so that made me think about why in the past people made like death masks. Right, when somebody died, you made a death mask to remember them if you had the money, or you had paintings done if you had the money. And then with the advent of early photography, suddenly you had a technology that was kind of more easily available to people on all kinds of financial scales. And the decade of when photography first became a bit of a thing in the 1840s coincided also with a cholera epidemic that killed a lot of people, so the death toll was very high. So these early photographers were called upon a lot of the time to take photographs of dead people. And I read somewhere that in terms of, you know, commemorating marriages and commemorating deaths, it was 3-1 commemorating deaths and to commemorate a marriage. And the way that they did these photos were not just photos of a corpse, but rather it was a remembrance of the person. So they even would animate the corpse sometimes to look alive. They would place a child, for example, with its favorite toys, prop it up so it looks like it's playing with their toy or reading a book. They would do their best to have these post-mortem photographs, as they were called, a remembrance of that person. Because, of course, this is the only photograph anybody ever took in their life. So if you could only take one photograph in your life, you took a photograph of your death so people could remember you after you crossed over.
And also the child, usually children, would then be sitting amongst the family with the siblings.
Yes.
But usually just.
But there was also this thing they did where they would take the pictures of the dead as they lay on a bed, basically with their eyes shut. I've seen those. I've seen actual photographs.
Yeah.
But I guess those were for poor people who they couldn't afford to animate.
No, actually, no. There were two. The photographers usually asked to do two photographs. One was a photograph of what was called the sleeping child, the peaceful child, and one was the animated child. So usually they took two photos. And the one that they displayed on a mantelpiece, for example, was the photo of the child with its things, or sometimes the things of the parents, the the parents' most expensive things. But also because the early photographs were done on were daguerreotypes, which were made from burnished copper, what they often did was they put the child on the daguerreotype. But if you held the daguerreotype in a certain way, your own reflection then reflected on it. So it looked like you were there with your child or your husband or your wife. So in this way, the early photographs were not just visual media, visual medium. They're actually a kind of textual, not textual, what do you call that medium? You can touch it. Okay, it's,
yeah.
Tactile.
Yeah, yeah.
Tactile medium as well.
Yeah.
It's one of the strange things about death. I mean, death is an end, of course, but it is so necessary for the survivors to have some memento, be it a grave or the ashes.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that, it's you are left absolutely bereft. So, I mean, I read a lot of history and I read a lot of military history. So one of the aspects that keeps returning is the dead bodies and the people back home. And so the people back home would be absolutely at a loss because they did not have anybody. And so that was why in the First World War, a lot of effort was made to make commemorations so that even if you were at home, if your child was, as in the case of my great grandparents, I mean, their child was, they lived in Wales, their child was in Damascus, but they would have mementos of that. And the Japanese, during the war, it was so essential that somebody go to Iwo Jima or Malaya or whatever and find a bone. To be able to take that back and do the funeral rites correctly. Without that, you're just absolutely at a loss, complete absence.
Yeah.
I guess it depends on the culture too. I mean, there's so many different cultural elements. You know, if you don't find a body, if the body is not laid to rest, the soul will never be at peace. And yet, there are other cultures which is like, That's not terribly important. There's even cultures where the body has to be there. Like, for example, you were going to talk about Torajans, but, you know, like certain Papua New Guinean tribes, it's like death to them is as long as you have the body, it's almost like a celebration because after 6 months of the loved one being underground, they, what's the word again? Exhume. They exhume the body, and I don't know how they prepare it, but they actually eat the person. And it sounds grim and gross, but it actually is sharing that person within the family and within the village. And, well, you know, there's just so many different ways to deal with death, really.
Well, the Torajans are really interesting because they have so many different kinds of funeral rites for different ages and different people. But the thing is, for them, death is not the end. Death is the most important thing in life, and that death is just part of life. And all the preparations in life are for death, and all the savings that they have are for death, not for weddings. I mean, traditionally people save up to get married, but here they save up for their funeral. And that's why often after somebody dies in the family, they keep the body in the same house with them until they have enough money to have a really proper funeral service. And at various times they never refer to that person as being dead. They say that they're resting, they're sleeping.
Like actors.
Like the parrot. Yeah.
Like the parrot. Or they're not feeling very well. But they take them out with them. They take them to the market sometimes. They take them to visit other people and just say, well, he's not feeling very well today.
So I'm sorry, the whole body. I'm sorry.
Yes, the whole body.
Torajan, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar. Where Torajan?
It's an Indonesian island. Yeah,
it's in Sulawesi.
Okay,
and that's why the Torajans don't like to travel very far because they're always afraid if they die far from home, then they've got a long way to travel to come back. That's because they have to come back.
Also, if they travel very far, the dead relative might insist to come along. Can you imagine customs, everything? It gets a bit messy.
some of them are animists, but many of them are Christian. Many of them are Muslim, but they still keep to this their beliefs about funeral rites. Is not influenced by their religious beliefs. They still continue their funeral practices, despite whatever religion they may have. But they have this one particular thing which I found really quite beautiful. So for children, when children die, they hollow out some part of a tree and they put the child inside the tree because then essentially what they feel that the tree and the child will fuse and become a new essence. And so they have these trees everywhere where some of the trees may have like six children. inside them, which then will fuse around these children. Wow. And I thought, well, this is very eco-friendly. Or this is kind of
way that people do that everywhere, people. Especially like hardwood forests.
Yeah, and now people are thinking about, you know, what will they do with their bodies when they die? People are thinking there's a new practice of now turning yourself into this kind of root of a tree, right? So you can sign up for this thing where your body will then nourish a tree. And when my cat was very sick recently, and I was kind of thinking, well, what will I do if he passes away? And I was thinking, would I bury him in the garden so that tree can grow from his body, so that he can live and be useful to the earth in some way, rather than, you know, putting him in a jar in my house. So it's interesting how I think things, we say things are new normal right now, but I kind of have found in during this time of reading and re-looking at things that actually is not really any new normal. Things are constantly changing and practices are constantly evolving. That there is 100 years ago, or 200 years ago, it was fine to take photographs of people when they were dead and display them on your mantelpiece. Now it's regarded as being a bit creepy. So things just change, practices change, attitudes change as well.
And technology helps. I mean, now we have so many mementos of even like, for example, my mother passed away recently, and even though she was from, you know, of an older generation, when we searched, we had lots of photographs, videos, even, you know, and it really helps. Technology really helps to push away some of the more arcane traditions.
Right.
But then, of course, you know, if there's one big electromagnetic pulse, half of our information is going to go anyway. But that's a different story.
Mm. Okay. Well, we must move on from death. You know, this episode started with me talking about generational change. Then we took a nostalgic trip back to the 1980s, and then we finished with death. I wonder if the three of us are trying to say something. So. We move on to the final part.
It's old people,
that's all. It's really bad. We've got to get young people on this show from now on. We've got to go to the final part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something that we think might be of interest, and I'm going to go first. Mine's very simple. It's a movie I watched the other day. It came out last year, and I hadn't heard of it. It's an HBO film. It's called Bad Education, starring Hugh Jackman. It's about embezzlement in a school district in the United States. Apparently a true story. It's just a really good film. You were talking about films from the 70s and stuff, Joe. This is like a classically structured, well-acted, well-directed film. The guy's second movie as a director. Just a very good film. No superheroes. It's about embezzlement in a school district. And it's called Bad Education. I think it's very good.
From what year again, Ken?
Last year. Yeah, 2019. Nah, what's your recommendation?
More the small screen. If you are in any way a fan of Patrick Stewart, which a lot of people are, he's been doing sonnets over the MCO, if you've noticed, lovely stuff, right? Or if you're a huge Star Trek fan, you should watch the new Star Trek series. It's one season thus far from last year also, I think, called Star Trek Picard. And it's about the character of Picard, who's now retired, and he's 80-something. And it brings you, I don't know how to say this, but if you're a Star Trek fan, it takes you sort of like a tour of that universe as it is now. But at the same time, there's so many callbacks to characters and plot lines and world building that was never resolved. And it's wonderful. It is actually, even if you're not a Star Trek fan, you don't know what's going on. You don't know who Riker is. You don't know who Data is. Patrick Stewart is very, very good in it. And it's shot wonderfully how the old Star Trek TV series were very, very static and very, you know, very bad sets and everything. This one is shot beautifully. It's like a film. It puts you into this future world, but it feels very, very grounded and very real. But it's also a lot of fun.
Where do you watch it?
I watched it. You can watch it on Netflix, and you can watch it on any of the streaming services. If you're naughty, you can get the pirate DVD, or you can what do they call it? Illegal downloads and stuff like that. But it's uh, it, nine episodes.
And sorry, what's it called again?
Star Trek .. Picard.
Okay.
So you know how all the shows are Star Trek Generation, Star Trek Voyager. It's only Star Trek. It's but Picard, a whole bunch of new characters, but also callbacks to all the old characters. And the fictitious history continues. And it's very good. It's just that Patrick Stewart, he's just getting better as an actor, I think.
Right.
The older he gets.
Okay, we're really... So this is Star Trek in their 80s.
This is Star episode, Trek 2020.
This episode, oh my God. Okay, so Star Trek .. Picard. And finally, Joe, what's yours?
Well, I kind of want to recommend two things, if I can. Because one of them is a bit vague. I would recommend going back and reading things that were really important to you when you were young. And understand, you know, because they say that you are that person, that's who you really are. And the things that you sort of gravitate to when you're, when I say young, I mean preteens,
huh?
Or teens even. When you were a teenager, what are those things that made you, as Cam said earlier, that made you feel, oh my God, my mind is blown?
Your first peek into the wider universe, bigger world.
Yeah,
your first understanding of that. Yeah, well, I'm doing that with Dune right now. Yeah.
Oh, I suddenly remembered actually where that happened with me. I think it was when I stole my father's copy of Leon Uris books, you know, that were forbidden to us because they were full of sex and other things. Just reading that illicitly and that excitement I had. I wonder what it'll feel like if I read it now. It might feel really tame, but at the time, you know, Exodus and all the rest of it were really exciting things. So I think you kind of go down into a kind of childhood Warren as well when you go back and you reread.
I think for me, not necessarily rereading, but I remember hearing Pink Floyd's song, Comfortably Numb. Mm. This is in 1979. So I was, 13 or something? So pretty young. And the song is about remembering childhood.
Right.
And it struck me then, it's like, oh, I am past childhood. I'm now at an age where I can remember childhood. Mm. I found it very moving that I'd actually departed from childhood.
The song means a lot more to you now, right? It's the same with me, a lot of Pink Floyd stuff. Do you remember the song, I Wish You Were Here?
Yeah.
I found that in the last 10 years or 15 years, I found that Wish You Were Here means so much more to me because it is a song about people who have gone through things and are now looking back, but also meeting friends from that time.
Mm.
You know, we're just two lost souls swimming. You know, it's if you're 15 or 20 or 25 even, you haven't had that past which has formed you. But Wish You Were Here is about going through all that. Mm. And reaching a point where you, me, and the three of us would sit back and go about, hey, you know, if we weren't in contact, in communication so much, we would go like, I wish we could sit down and talk about the ICT days or whatever. Yeah, you know, well, that's what Wish You Were Here was about.
That has been what this episode has been, actually. But Joe, you had a second thing.
Maybe because I've been spending a lot of time in my garden, so I kind of want to think about gardening as being a cultural thing, a bit of culture. So I would recommend watching gardening videos, which I'm finding quite wonderful, actually. People who just really love dirt. Yeah. Mm. And, you know, one particular video I watched recently with this man, because I've been composting, and he composts everything. And he was very excited because he found a dead pigeon. And so he dug up his bit of his patch of soil and buried it. And then he was showing us, okay, I'm going to dig it up now. He was like a mixture of David Attenborough and a sort of very excited archaeologist doing a kind of dig. And of course, the exciting thing is weeks later when he dug it up, there's just nothing left. There's not even a bone, right? So the earthworms and all the bugs have just taken care of it. And
yeah, it's gone into his garden. It's gone into the ecosystem.
Gone to his garden. And I thought
you should get a recommendation within Joe's recommendations to get a composting machine. It's like a pot. It's like a green pot. I mean, you can Google it. Apparently it'll help a lot. And look, I got this. The audience can't see it, but I've got garden shears.
Right.
And I'm going to be doing a lot of gardening myself too.
Oh, cool.
Okay, so Joe, we clearly know where Joe's mind is, dust to dust, ashes to ashes.
I didn't think of that.
Yeah. And so that brings us to the end of this week's show. I feel compelled to say things like Taylor Swift, Solange, just to kind of like update us.
Maybe it should be called a bit of all culture.
I've got this one, yeah. And
I thought this episode was lit. Lit,
yeah, oh, wow, daddy-o. So,
daddy-o, Cam.
Sorry, oh, what have I done? Cancelled. And only reminds me now to thank Joe Kukazas.
Thank you, Cam.
And Na'am Murad.
Always a pleasure, Cam.
And myself, Cam Ruslan. And please join us next week, where actually we are, in fact, having a lot of young people here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.